You're listening to Their Finest Hour, a podcast from the University of Oxford.
The white cliffs of Dover, tomorrow, just you wait and see.
I'm here with Shrabani Basu, who is a best-selling author. She is the author of Victoria and Abdul, which was made into a movie with Judi Dench and is considered to be a sequel to the Mrs. Brown movie that came out in the 1990s, I believe. So it was a very impressive movie and based on a true story, a largely unknown true story, which was very much brought to people's attention as a result of your book. But you were also the author of The Spy Princess, which is the main biography of Noor Inayat Khan. And Shrabani was the first person to profile Noor Inayat Khan. And really, it is her biography that has transformed Noor into the household name that she has become in recent decades. Everywhere you turn, you see Noor's image whenever it comes to commemorating South Asian participation in the Second World War. First of all, why do you think Noor Inayat Khan has become so representative of the contribution of the Raj during the Second World War?
Well, it's surprising that she wasn't known before, actually, because she was awarded the George Cross. And that is why I wanted to write her story. I said she was, you know, awarded the George Cross by Britain. Here's somebody who had the Croix de Guerre given to her by France, highest honours, and yet her story was not known. As I was walking in the Imperial War Museum, they had a room dedicated to the George Cross and Victoria Cross. Mm. And there was photographs of the others, but no Noor. Mm. And only three women were given the George Cross. Two of them posthumously. One was Noor, one was Violette Zabel. And it hurt me at that time that, you know, why has she been ignored? Is it because she was Indian? She's not known? Did her story fall through, you know, the stories of two continents? What happened? And I did really want to write her biography. And this is a long time back when nobody knew anything about Noor, of course. But I wasn't getting enough. And it's only when her files were declassified in 2003. So my book is quite old now. I wrote it, I mean, I did the research 20 years ago and the book was published in 2006. But that was the start for me. And then, of course, meeting her family, putting the whole story together. But I just found that as soon as the book was published, people were fascinated by her story. And I got letters. Suddenly the postman was ringing me. Those were the days pre-email. You know, he was carrying sacks of letters for me. All sorts of people saying, why didn't we know her story? There should be a memorial for her. Why do we not know this? And this was across. This wasn't just Indians. It wasn't South Asians. A lot of English people. Lots of people from all over the world writing. And that's when I said, okay, you know, something about her story. I think it's her bravery to, if I want to just think of what it is, it's her bravery. It's her sacrifice. It's the fact that in 1940s, there is this young Muslim woman who is ready to sacrifice her life in the fight against fascism, and she's of Indian origin. So the whole thing is, I think there's an element of fascination about her background. There's an element, for me, it was, how did she get there? How did she get to the heart of the war in Europe? It's what I wanted to know. And so I started following that lead. And of course, then her story, you know, just, it was a story that engrosses you. Her bravery is just, you know, beyond belief that she didn't crack under interrogation. The manner of her death, of course, you know, is tragic. She was killed in Dachau concentration camp. She was brutally tortured, but she didn't reveal anything. And I think it's this extraordinary bravery. It's her courage. It's the fact that she wanted to stand up for her ideals. She believed in nonviolence. She believed in equality of religions and people and not in boundaries. I think it's all these ideals that she wanted to fight for that have struck a chord with people across the world.
I remember because we spoke together at the Royal Air Force Museum about a year ago, I think it was, or just over a year ago, and I remember very strongly being moved and struck by her, the way you told her story, the story of her origins, her family background. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about her family background and her upbringing?
Yeah, I think her family was really important because, well, for those who don't know, Noor's father was Indian. His name was Hazrat Inayat Khan, and her mother was American. So Hazrat Inayat Khan, her father, he was a musician, he was a professor of music, and he was a Sufi. So Sufism is a branch of Islam that believes in music and meditation. And so it's not very orthodox. And he was instructed, he was from India, he was from Baroda and Hyderabad, South India mainly. She herself was descended from royalty. So she is descended from Tipu Sultan, the tiger of Mysore, ruler of the southern Indian state of Mysore, who died, incidentally, fighting the British. So it's a very, you know, the ancestry is very awesome, very interesting. And the fact that he then, she has mixed heritage, her mother is American. So Hazrat Inayat Khan goes, he's told by his teacher to take Sufism to the West, which is how he goes to America. He goes, he's teaching music and Sufism. And he meets Noor's mother, they get married, they move to Europe. And Noor is born in Moscow. he had been invited there for a concert. Noor is born in Moscow, then the family moved to London. And then finally, after the First World War, they move to France. And they live on the outskirts of Paris in a place called Suresnes. And it's a beautiful house. The house is still the family house. It was gifted by one of the Sufis. He had many Sufi followers who were German, Dutch, Americans, and they all followed him. So she is brought up in this atmosphere. This is Noor's childhood, is brought up in an atmosphere of music and meditation, open house where the Sufis come in the summer, they have concerts. She herself played the harp. She played the Indian instrument, the veena, like her father. Her brothers and sisters all played, they were a quartet. Her brother played the violin, another sister played the piano. They would give performances, they'd have concerts. So it was a very idyllic childhood. And then her father died young, when she was very young, and Noor took on the responsibilities of looking after all her siblings. But as she grew up as a young adult, she started writing children's stories. Mm-hmm. She was, of course, a musician. So she was a dreamer. She was very beautiful. It was a very elite background as well, you know, no getting away from that. It was also very, I'll say, she had her brothers, sisters. It was a very paternalistic family, very Indian in, you know, even though they were in the West, it was a traditional Indian family. Her mother used to wear a sari and took a Muslim name of Amina. So against this background, she's a writer, she's a dreamer. Of course, she's being published in newspapers, in the Sunday newspapers. And she's just published a book. It's called The 20 Jataka Tales. It's a retelling of the tales of the Buddha for children. So it's sort of Aesop's fables with a moral in them. But it's 1939, you know, war is just on the corner. And in 1940, when the German army is just about to enter Paris, she and her brother Vilayat, she was very close to her brother. They sit down in this beautiful room. It is the Oriental room. They sit there, they look over the lights of Paris, and they decide that though we are Sufis, though we believe in nonviolence, we can't stand by and watch. We have to defend. We have to do our role. So they decide to go to England and volunteer for the war effort. So the family joins all the refugees leaving Paris at this time. And as they are driving through, Vilayat has his little car and they're going. The German bombers are bombing down on them. And Vilayat says, when I go to England, I'm going to join the RAF. And they do. I mean, he does. They both land up in London and he signs up for the RAF. And Noor just follows her brother, really, and says, well, I'll sign up for the women's wing. And that's how she ends up there. She goes and joins the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. And suddenly she is just aircraft's woman with a number. And she is just a woman with all other women. And she has a uniform which she loves. And she actually loves this anonymity. She's no longer in this elated company of the Sufis and the peers. And she's just a number. She's sleeping in a Nissan hut with the others. Mm-hmm. And she's making a lot of friends. She feels she has a role to do. Yeah. She's very excited. And crucially, at this stage, they are being trained in radio operation. So all this is going to play a role.
Yes.
In the future.
Yes. I'm just wondering, for our listeners, how does she make this transition from being a Royal Air Force officer to being an agent, an SOE-trained mm-hmm. agent working in F section, mm-hmm. which is, as many people who know anything about the work of SOE in France, there wasn't a great success rate among F section members, and there were quite a lot of people who died mm-hmm. in the course of carrying out their duties, of mm-hmm. which Nor would unfortunately be one. But how does she make this transition from the Royal Air Force to SOE?
So the most important thing is these women are the first batch of women being trained in radio operation. Mm. Up till now, it was only the men handling radio. So Noor is trained. She is very good. I've seen her reports. Morse code, excellent. They're all marked VG. So she's a fast learner. She's good at her Morse code. And this secretive organization called the SOE are looking out for people with language skills and radio skills. And Noor fits the bill. She speaks fluent French. She speaks French like a native. She's been brought up in Paris. And of course, she is a very good radio operator. So they invite her for an interview. She gets this letter. She thinks it might be a commission in the RAF, and she's very excited. So she goes there, and she finds, to her surprise, there is one man at this interview room, and he's speaking to her in French. Well, she replies, but very quickly, she is told she will be sent as an agent to France. She will not be in uniform. So she'll have no protection. And if she is caught, she will be shot. And will she take the job? And Noor says yes. And it's not a knee-jerk reaction because Noor was determined to play a role. She wanted a more active role. She was not someone, you know, she could have volunteered for the Red Cross behind lines. She was a Sufi. It wasn't even her war in that sense. She was of Indian origin. And her father was, he was a nationalist. He knew Gandhi. He knew Sarojini Naidu. He used to sing for the soldiers in the First World War. And so the thought of Indian freedom was something very close to her heart, which is the whole, you know, the contradiction that is going on here. But Noor is so focused. She goes for an RAF interview where they ask her point blank. They say that, you know, where does your loyalty lie? This is 1942. The Quit India movement has started. Gandhi has called on the British to quit India. The moment the war breaks out in Europe, all the Indian nationalist leaders are put in jail. So all the top leaders, Nehru, Gandhi, are going to spend the entire period of the Second World War in prison. And Noor is very aware of this. She knows 1942 is the time she goes for her RAF interview, and they ask her. And she's really offended that they doubt her loyalty. She loses her temper. She says that at this time, it is important to win the war and defeat fascism. And she says, after the war, I believe in Indian independence. And she is absolutely frank about it. And they are appalled, shocked and appalled. But I guess somewhere they respect her, you know, her truthfulness. So that's Noor. At this time, about 28, she is focused on what she has to do. She knows that this war is important. She's determined to do her bit. And, yep, so she signs up. She accepts the job. And she says that I know that her letter she writes is really very moving. It's in the National Archives. And she says that I realize how my mother is going to feel my loss. But I also realize how petty family ties are when something as great as winning this war is at stake. And I found that really, that just shows Noor's character shining through. And so she starts her life in the Secret Service. It's a whole new world. And she has to simply disappear. Her friends don't know where she's gone. Overnight, there's just a folded blanket on her bed. And she's gone.
It's remarkable, really, her fortitude and determination, and also her forthrightness when it came to the cause that for which the Allies were fighting the war. And there's a famous quotation I attributed to her, I don't know whether it's misattributed to her, mm-hmm. which is, when it comes to Indian independence, I am your enemy, but when it comes to the common cause that we have, defeating mm-hmm. fascism, mm-hmm. I'm with you to the end. Something along those lines. Mm-hmm. There have been all sorts of paraphrasings mm-hmm. of this particular quotation about, mm-hmm. which summarised kind of her political mm-hmm. views. Mm-hmm. In terms of the politics of the time, mm-hmm. and this is an important question, and the controversy around this still lives with us to this day, regarding India's participation in the Second World War. What was the political situation in India at the time with mm-hmm. regard to the independence movement and support for the Allied war effort? Was India willing mm-hmm. to participate in the Second World War? And what were the problems associated or attached mm-hmm. to India's participation in the war?
Yeah, it's actually really different between the First World War and the Second World War. So First World War, even Gandhi said, you know, he was recruiting people. He sent out a letter of support. He said, we must fight for this war. And there was active support from all the Indian native princes and the government. So the First World War was very different. By the time we've reached the Second World War, the Indian freedom movement has really picked up a pace. It's gone into fourth gear. And as I said, that the moment war is declared, all the top Congress leaders are jailed. They're going to spend the whole 5 years in jail, in prisons. And Gandhi in 1942 very strongly calls the Quit India movement, which means leave India. This is following a failed Simon Commission report on how to best give independence. And he just called it a complete failure, a complete sham. And he said, quit India. So the minute Quit India is declared, it goes up a level. But at the same time, the danger, which I think many of the Congress leaders knew, was that Germany might have its designs on India too. So in this sense, they were supporting the war effort. They said, okay, let it happen. And they also felt that after the war, it would give them this negotiating, if they supported the British, after that independence, they could negotiate independence better. So this was a lot of the thinking. And of course, it was the biggest volunteer army. 2.5 million volunteered for the war effort. This happens across India. For the first time, we see Indian officers, which we didn't see in the First World War, because there were no Indian officers then. But because they felt that, an English soldier would never want to say salute a native Indian. But this changes in the Second World War. There is active recruitment training. They are sent to Sandhurst. You have Sandhurst-trained Indian officers. The balance of power, in a way, has shifted. There's quite a few Indian officers. There's Air Force officers, across all ranks. And there is this feeling that if we do this, we will negotiate better terms for independence. And that is definitely a thinking going on there.
And in terms of like the Indian Army, Air Force and Navy, in terms of those who are in the ranks, but also those who form the officer class. Mm-hmm. And as you said, there are Sandhurst trained officers. There are definitely quite a number of Indian mm-hmm. colonels. Like mm-hmm. there's a sort of an assumption mm-hmm. that the officer corps were predominantly British, mm-hmm. be Anglo-Irish, or mm-hmm. they could be Eton or Oxford educated or whatnot. Mm-hmm. But actually, it's not the case. You have very much a mixed officer...
For the first time, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. officer cohort. Yeah, it is quite unique. And this is basically the military leadership that goes on to inherit mm-hmm. the armed forces of an independent Pakistan, yeah, independent mm-hmm. Ceylon, mm-hmm. later Sri Lanka, mm-hmm. and an independent India. And they mm-hmm. really lead yeah. the armed forces thereafter. Mm-hmm. What are their politics, though? And were they all loyal to the end?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. So most of them, let's say, I'd say 80-85% are loyal. They are army men with disciplined army training. They will be loyal no matter what. So there is definitely that army. Very loyal. there is the other side is that you have Subhash Chandra Bose from India. He is somebody who is, he's left, he's sort of ideologically, he's clashed with Nehru in a way, and he's going to leave the Congress, and he's going to try to, he has a more radical approach to the gaining of independence. He feels that this non-cooperation, non-violent method is not going to work with the British. And he sets out to get support from Russia and Germany, and for, you know, my enemy's enemy is my friend sort of philosophy is his in a way. And what he wants to do is recruit supporters who from the POW camps. So the German POWs, the Indians who are prisoners of war, he feels he's going to get them to his side to support him. And they are going to march in and take India. So it's a bizarre plan, but it's, you know, it's there. And he wants to make friends with the Japanese. So he goes, I mean, to put it short, he goes from Germany to Japan, Singapore, and he wants his, it's called the Indian National Army, the INA. And this wing, largely composed of volunteers as well as a lot of POWs, he wants them to be part of his army, and they're going to enter from the eastern flank. So that is the only bit where the prisoners of war under this, you know, this whole, because he's a very charismatic leader, and he, you know, no doubts about how strongly he felt about Indian independence. He just, I think, I mean, the way I see it is, you know, you don't go to Germany, you don't go shake hands with Hitler. Not for this war, not for any war. So
one thing that struck me about Chandra Bose was the fact that he was actually a communist. He was an ideological communist originally, if I'm not mistaken. And in that respect, in terms of...
a socialist, actually.
A socialist, yes.
But in a great admirer of the Soviets.
Absolutely. But the fact that he's prepared with a socialist mindset, which is probably more akin to communist ideology than a fascist ideology, the fact that he's willing to deal with the fascists... There's a lot of analogies to be made with the situation with socialist IRA people from Ireland. I'm thinking of Frank Ryan, who was an avowed socialist communist who fought fascism in Spain, but then later ended up working for the Germans and living in Nazi Germany right to the end of the war. I'm kind of caught by the irony of those situations and the fact that they're happening in two different separately in two different countries which were once colonies of the British Empire, territories of the British Empire, and remarkably similar scenarios. But it's the legacy of Bose and the Indian National Army is, I believe, still felt very strongly to this day. Talking about the war and talking about this effort that India made to win the Second World War for the Allies and then settle the question of independence thereafter is sort of tainted by the INA and by Bose and attitudes towards it. And in particular also, I think, if I'm not mistaken, a great resentment that was harboured towards the British for the way in which they left things. Do you have anything to say about this?
Absolutely. I mean, all of this is true in so many ways, because Bose really fired the patriotic spirit in people. So his soldiers were ready to march. And he was known to, you know, have entered from the northeast side and planted the first flag of independent India. And that's still... sort of, you know, galvanize people. And I mean, you can imagine the emotions at this stage where you feel independence is coming, but there's a war going on. And Bengal itself, from where, you know, Bose is a Bengali, always with a revolutionary history, Bengal is always known to be, you know, the revolutionary sort of hotbed in India. And, well, they're the most affected by the war as well, because you have the Bengal famine from 1943. Bengal is paying the price, literally 3 million dead, because to support this war effort, grain is being drained to feed the army. Grain is not being sent to Bengal. The ships are bypassing it. So there's a lot going on there to unpack. He was obviously very misguided, but you can see where he was coming from. You know, this is the sentiment at this time. They just felt it's not happening. This needs to happen now. Now seize the moment sort of a scene. But what was really interesting is that just before, the main reason in 1947, and the war's over 1945, What was one of the main triggers as well for the independence in 47 was the trial of the INA prisoners. That promised to be a real powder keg, because these people, if you tried them and said it was treason, India was going to explode, because they knew that, okay, you know, this has happened, but the sentiment pro Bose was very strong. So it's actually abandoned. None of them are tried. And the minute these INA trials are abandoned, it's a sign. The British don't want to deal with this, you know, get on with it, give them independence. So there's a lot that happened. And so some of it is Bose as well. You know, the sort of fiery spirit that he manages to evoke in people, the patriotism. There were young women who signed up. He's the first one to have women in the army. So he had a women's unit. It was called the Rani Lakshmibai unit, based on this warrior queen who fought in the mutiny. So 19th century warrior queen, Rani Lakshmibai. So it was called the Lakshmi unit, Rani Lakshmi unit. He employed women. So he was very egalitarian. I mean, it was also very multi-faith. You had Muslims, you had Hindus, you had Sikhs, and they were all, you know, allegiance to Bose and to freedom. So there was a lot of positives in his structure, but of course he just went to the fascists to try to win the war, which went very wrong. And then he was killed in a explosion, and nobody believed he was dead for a long time. It was 100 conspiracy theories, so you know, it went on.
The fall of Singapore must have been a key catalyst for quite a lot of what happened. And in particular, you also have the Japanese encroaching on the borders of what was then known as British India, or the Raj, coming in through Burma. And you have INA units in that particular theatre of conflict. And you've so much going on in this particular part, which is basically modern-day Bangladesh.
It's the northeast of India.
Northeast of India. And the Bengal state as well, of India, of modern-day India. You have so much going on at that particular point. I'm using a military term now, but it's a culminating point, really, in the war. And definitely the impact of the loss of Singapore, it's like an earthquake right throughout the British world, the British Empire. There are some who say that the British Empire really came to an end, or the end of empire was sparked by this particular event. Certainly it seemed to have given comfort to any Indian enemies of Britain and the Empire, what had happened. And no doubt quite a lot of prisoners, Indian army prisoners from Singapore, went over to the INA from the fall of Singapore. This would have happened around about this time. Noor would have been in SOE, when all this occurred. What were her feelings about everything that was happening? Or did she ever convey any feelings about this particular crucial point?
So what I know is from her brothers. Vilayat told me the story about the RAF interview, and he said how she came back shaking because she was so angry that they doubted her loyalty. And she said, "I've never lost my temper, but I, you know," she just couldn't take it. And she said, "At this moment, I am with you. And after the war, I support Indian independence." And her younger brother, Hidayat, told me many years later as well that if Noor had survived, that would be her next battle. So she was very focused. I mean, at this age, it is amazing how focused she was, because she knew this had to be done. This was important. And she's ready to do her bit. There's absolutely no doubt in her mind. She never has any doubts about which side she's on. Yeah. She's very focused.
So the kind of politics, the more extreme politics of Bose and the INA would not have held any appeal to her at all?
Not at all. She was an admirer of Gandhi and Nehru. Especially Nehru. She gifted Vilayat his autobiography for his birthday. So he has that inscribed copy, which is quite moving because it's all in the middle of the war.
Going forward in terms of her work for SOE and her preparations for deployment to France, what is known about that particular period of her training, preparation? What are thoughts? Like, we've already heard quite a lot about what she was prepared to do. She had resigned herself that if this would cost her her life, that she was prepared to give it. What was the typical kind of preparation for somebody who was going to be dropped into France?
So basically, it's It's the start of her life in secret, and they are taken to country houses all around UK, and they were trained. And the training is mainly, of course, Morse code, radio, but how to live a clandestine life. The fact that they'd have a false passport, a false cover story, how to lie your way out of a situation, how to get dead letterboxes, live letterboxes, dead letterbox being a place where you drop off things, messages. Live letterbox is a person, somebody in a post office or a corner shop who will carry a message for you. How to recruit sources. Basically, all the, you know, the key training skills of a Secret Service agent. She has to do all this. And what's more, she has to do weapons training, something Noor hates because this is not her background. So the reports at this time are really interesting because they're quite negative. They say this operative hates weapons training, not very good at it. But others say that she tries very hard. So she knows she's got to overcome this. She's got to do it. And she will train. There are others that say she's a very fast runner. So she's really focuses on her physical training. She knows it's, you know, she needs to be really physically fit. Others say she's very good at clambering on roofs, which is very useful for a radio operator because she has to put up her aerial. So she's doing, she's taking it really seriously. She's given a code name, Madeline, and in her files in the National Archives, you can see how she's meticulously practicing her signature. There's a whole page where she signed Madeline. So it shows you all the preparation before she sets out. And of course, her Morse code is improving all the time. She is a very good radio operator. Controversial reports. She's one of the most controversial agents because there's many who say she's too dreamy, she's not suited for the job. Just imagine a dreamer, a non, you know, person who believes in non-violence, a person who says, I will never tell a lie, being sent out there as a secret agent where the first thing you're doing is lying. You have a false identity. So in so many ways, she was such an unlikely spy. But, you know, she did it. She had a job to do and she was going to do it.
Could you tell us a little bit about her time in France and the lead up to her capture?
So on the 16th of June, it's always a full moon night. So 16th, 17th of June, 1943, she hasn't even finished her training. She is needed in France. And the reason she is needed is because wireless operators, who had all been men up to now, their life expectancy was 6 weeks and they were dropping like flies and they needed radio operators. So Noor becomes the first woman radio operator to be infiltrated into occupied France. It's amazing. She is there with a, you know, scent on this Lysander flight, which always takes off on a full moon night so that the landing site is visible. But of course, the other side is that those on the ground can also see the plane landing. So you could be shot even as you're trying to land. But anyway, she lands. She's given all these elaborate circuits that she has to join, maps, codes. She has a false passport. She goes in there, makes her way to Paris, and she joins the biggest network there. It's called the Prosper Circuit. And it's led by a man called Francis Sutto. And his lit team, he has a... Every SOE operator work, they work in threes. So they have a radio operator, a courier, and the leader. And they're not supposed to really meet each other too much. The radio operator is supposed to just sit there and do the job, you know, send the messages. The courier is out in the field. The leader is operating everything. But the Prosper Circuit is huge. It is the biggest circuit in France. It goes right down to the south of France. And it has sub-circuits. And so this is what also makes it very sort of a sitting duck for infiltration as well, because it was too big, too unwieldy in many ways. So within a week of her landing, the circuit is blown, is the term, when it's been infiltrated and the agents were outed. And the top leaders, this whole Prosper Circuit, Francis Suttle, his radio operator and his courier, they're all arrested. So suddenly, within a week of landing, Noor is in the hot spot. She is all alone, circuits blown, and she just has to follow her training, which is as soon as you hear of arrest, go underground, lie low. And she does that. And then she sends out a message to London that this has happened. And London actually asks her to return. They say it's very dangerous. We'll send your flight out for you. Come back. But Noor says she's the last radio operator, the last link left between London and Paris. And she says she's going to stay on. She's going to rebuild the circuit and she's going to send the messages, keep it alive. And it's amazing because she actually does that. Whereas most of the radio operators were gone in 6 weeks, Noor survives for 3 months. She rebuilds the circuit. She now starts doing the job of 6 radio operators. She's also the courier. She goes, meets French resistance agents. She gives them money and arms. She's literally handing over, typical, you see spy dramas, meet on a park bench, hand over something, X marks the spot. This is where the arms are going to be dropped. She's instrumental in flying agents out. She is doing the job rolled in of 6 radio operators and the wireless operators the courier and the leader of the circuit practically. And she manages to set up links. She works with local resistance people. And also she's using all her contacts. She's lived in Paris. She has a music teacher. She has a friend. She knows who she can rely on.
She has a pre-existing network.
Yep. And she uses them. So she has to transmit. Her job as a wireless operator is the most dangerous. And I'll explain why it's dangerous. It's because the wireless is disguised in a suitcase, which is about 2 feet big. It weighs 15 kilos. It's quite heavy. And she has to carry this everywhere. So just imagine Paris, with a Gestapo crawling everywhere, informers everywhere. She's on the metro with a suitcase. She can be stopped anytime. If she's caught, she'll be arrested. And she has these narrow escapes. She has to think on her feet. Not only is this bulky wireless, it also has a 70-foot aerial that she has to put up somewhere without being noticed. And she has to send her message fast. It has to be accurate. And she has to get out as fast as possible. So it's all this pressure because the German listening devices, as the messages go out, they can hear and they start zoning in on an area.
Triangulating.
Yes. They start switching off the power and they come closer and they know exactly where it's coming from. And within minutes, you can find a van driving up and, some German officer coming out and arresting you. So she has to take this heavy suitcase, put up the 70-foot aerial, transmit correctly, and get out of there. And she does it. She is visiting her teacher, school teacher, and she goes to the house. Her doctor, Noor just lands up. And they know why she's here. They just give her a room. She does it. She's out. She changes her looks. She changes her appearance, dyes her hair, changes her clothes. She's on the move. They can't catch her. So this suddenly, this dreamer, this woman, a musician, a writer, is transformed into Madeleine, the secret agent, and the Germans can't get her.
How does she end up coming undone?
So she would have actually returned to London. The flight was coming mid-October. She'd said goodbye to her friends, and she said, "I'm going back home," but she was betrayed. And this is the tragedy. She was betrayed by the sister of one of her co-agents. And it's a story of jealousy. This lady, Renee Gary, was just jealous of Noor. Everybody was in love with Noor. She was good at her work. She was beautiful. And there was another SOE agent called Anthelm who was in love with Noor. Renee was in love with Anthelm. Usual triangle. And she just went to the Gestapo headquarters and gave up her address. And she was paid 100,000 francs for this. The Germans later said that they would have paid 10 times that amount because Noor was one of the most important agents in the field. So once they had her address, they entered her flat. Noor lets herself in at night. She's been avoiding the Gestapo all day. She lets herself in and there's a French officer waiting for her, Pierre Carthot. But she puts up a fight. She doesn't just go down quietly. She bites him, she attacks him, she draws blood, and he can't take this one, petite 5'2 lady to the headquarters. He calls in reinforcements, and then finally there's a whole lot of them. They appear, they take her, bundle her into the car, take her to Avenue Foch. 84 Avenue Foch was the Gestapo headquarters in Paris, one of the poshest boulevards in Paris, and that's where she's taken.
And people who went into 84 Boulevard Foch tended not to come out. Would that be the case? Or?
Some of them did. Some of them did. But Noor makes 2 escape attempts. Mm-hmm. She's not, as I said, she was in full fighting form. There was no way she was... She was taking her training, everything she'd learned. Mm-hmm. So the minute she goes, she says, I need to use the toilet. She goes into the bathroom and she's out of the window. But they see her on the ledge, they pull her in. So that's a failed attempt. Second attempt is more serious. She taps on her cell room, or Morse code on the wall, sets, connects with other prisoners. They plan this escape. If it had succeeded, it would be like those escapes from Colditz that we hear about. But unfortunately, they get up on the roof, but the RAF starts bombing at that time. The air raid sirens go off. They check the prisoners' rooms. They find 3 missing. They are on the roof. They bring them down. And the commandant of the Gestapo headquarters there, he lines them up against the wall and he's going to shoot them. He can shoot them point blank. Something in him, he can't pull his trigger on Noor. He just puts his hands down. He says, if all of you sign up a treaty that you'll never make an escape attempt, I let you stay. One of them signs, Star. The 2 of them, Noor, of course, refuses to sign. And so does the second agent. He's a French resistance. He doesn't sign either. So they are both then sent to Germany. So Noor again becomes the first woman agent to be sent to a German prison. She's sent to Forzheim prison in Germany. And there she is kept in shackles, in isolation. She is chained. Her hands and feet are chained. There's a chain passing from her feet to her hands. She's starved. She's beaten. This, and of course, the interrogation continues, you know, tell us who you are, who are the contacts, etc. And she doesn't reveal anything. She just gives her name as Nora Baker, which is a take on her mother's name, which was Ora Baker. And she uses sort of Noor. So it's Nora Baker that she uses. They don't know anything otherwise. They've never got to know her real name. 10 months she spends in Forzheim prison. And despite this being beaten back in blue, starved, you know, the diet is just potato peel soup. She's tortured. Fellow prisoners can hear her crying in her cell, but she doesn't give up. She still manages to establish contact with other prisoners. And crucially, she keeps up their spirits, you know, says, I'm here. I'm a British officer. She also gives her address and says, after the war, we will celebrate. When they hear that the Allies have invaded, all this news comes to them. They sing it to her and she hears it. And she writes, Vive la France, you know, 4th of July. Mm. And then all these are scratched on bowls. And then she also gives her address, which is 4 Taverton Street, Bloomsbury. And this was important because the prisoner, after the war, she comes looking for Noor. And that's how we know what happened to Noor. But basically, after 10 months of torture where she doesn't give away anything, one night in September, she's pulled out of her cell and she's transported with 3 other SOE agents who are picked up from another prison and they are sent to Dachau concentration camp. They are told on the way that they are being sent for agricultural work. It feels like a picnic. Their handcuffs are removed. They're given sausages. Suddenly, she's speaking English with some other agents. So it's a few hours of freedom out of the cell, out after 10 months being in isolation. They look at these beautiful Bavarian mountains. Then they go to Munich, change for Dachau. They take their suitcase and walk up to the concentration camp. And of course, when you enter there, they know it's not an agricultural place for agricultural labor. The words outside are marked Frei, which is inscribed on every concentration camp, means work will set you free. But of course, that didn't happen. Yeah. And they can see it's a grim place. At Dachau, Noor is removed from the other 3. She is labeled Nacht und Nebel, which means night and fog, which means she's highly dangerous. So suddenly this, you know, this gentle Sufi writer is now a highly dangerous prisoner. She's isolated and she is tortured further. She is beaten and kicked all night. And finally, this sadistic officer, SS officer, just puts a gun to her head and shoots her. And she, according to eyewitnesses, she doesn't go quietly. She screams liberty even as she is shot. So he doesn't break her spirit. And ultimately, she wins. You know, they've got her body, but she wins. So this was Noor. And again, eyewitnesses say shortly after that, the bodies are dragged to the crematorium, the fires are lit, and her ashes are scattered. And there is a field in a little garden in Dachau where all the ashes of all the prisoners were, or all the inmates were scattered. It's like a garden of remembrance now. And there is a plaque in Dachau to commemorate the four SOE women who were killed there. It's in the crematorium. And of course, for her bravery, Noor was posthumously awarded the Croix de Guerre by France and the George Cross by Britain.
What are the sources that tell us about her time incarcerated in Paris, in Germany, and Dachau in mm-hmm. particular? What sources do we have mm-hmm. That tell us about those final months of her life?
So in Avenue Foch, when she is taken as a prisoner in Paris, we have the account from the other prisoner she tries to escape with, Star, who survived the war. And he came back, and in his debrief, he gave the whole escape attempt, and he says that it was all Noor's idea. And so he does say that, and he gives it in detail as to how they tried to escape. And in Forzheim, we have the account from this French lady called Yolande de la Grève. And it's really interesting because after the war is over, 13 SOE agents don't come back. And their head, Vera Atkins, she is the one who sent these women into the field for the first time. And she feels directly responsible and she's determined to go and search for them. And so she's going from concentration camp to, you know, piecing together this story. And she thinks that Noor has been killed in Natzweiler concentration camp in France. And she tells Noor's family that. So 1946, she tells Vilayet that Noor has been killed by lethal injection in Natzweiler. So he tells her, she writes to Vilayet that Noor has been killed in Natzweiler concentration camp and that the trials will start soon. So the family is just shattered. It's, you know, it's been almost a year after the war. Noor hasn't come back. They've been told she's missing. And then this news, and Vilayet goes and says Noor has been burnt alive, he tells her friend. Anyway, so this harrowing news is conveyed to the family. But within months, they receive a letter from Yolande de la Grève. Vilayet receives a letter saying that she was a prisoner with Noor in Forzheim, and she gives the dates. So Vilayet goes to Vera Atkins and he says this, he writes to her and says, I have received this letter. This doesn't tally with the account that she was killed in Natzweiler. And meanwhile, other sources have also told Vera Atkins. So she receives this news about Noor being in Forzheim. And that is all because she had scratched her address on this bowl that she could come looking for her. And so now they know there is a different line to pursue. And they find out that four agents were taken to Dachau, and that is where they were killed on early hours of 13 September 1944, just a few months before Dachau was liberated. So the Forzheim prison, what we know of what happened there is through the eyewitness account of Yolande de la Grève, as well as the interrogations of the prison wardens, who say very frankly how he was instructed to chain her up, and he didn't know why he had to, because she didn't look like a highly dangerous prisoner. He removes her handcuffs and he's told by Berlin to put them back on again. So the whole details of what happens in Forzheim are there from the reports. And Dachau, we have these eyewitness reports, as well as the person, the interrogation of the person who escorted Noor and the other girls to Dachau. And his name was Wasma Ott, and he was carrying, and Christian Ott and Wasma, and both of them, they were carrying the execution order with them. So they knew what is going to happen to these girls. So he gives his debrief, his interrogation after the war. So we have several accounts and vivid descriptions of what happens. Many of these are from the Nazis, obviously. Hans Kiefer, who was the commandant of Avenue in Paris, he gives his deposition. And he says, he tries to cry off and say, I didn't know that she would be sent to Dachau, and I sent her to Karlsruhe. And he even cries at this interrogation. And Vera Atkins, who's listening to him, is really angry with him. And she says, Kiefer, if anyone should be crying, it should be me. So cut this comedy out. You know, she really gives it to him. She is so angry. But yeah, so that was Kiefer's account. So we have Kiefer saying how she did not say a word. And, you know, despite all the interrogation attempts, she never revealed anything. And we have this from the radio operator in the German prison who was working their radios. We have this from Kiefer. We have the accounts of what happened in these camps. And then the last bit in Dachau, we have from eyewitness accounts who say she went down screaming, Liberté.
Yeah, it's an absolutely incredible story, extremely moving, and you tell it so well. It's a bit of a cheeky question, but has anybody approached you about the rights to the story?
Oh, almost immediately. They went, but it's taken a long time, so they're still optioned. Yeah. It's now optioned for television.
Yes.
It's also been optioned for theatre, so let's see what happens.
There has been a dramatic representation of Norcan's service in SOE in a recent film, I think a couple of years ago.
In which she's one of the characters.
Yes.
But, it's about Vera Atkins. Yes. But it's fictional, of course. Yes. And But this would be...
This would be the actual story.
It would be a story. Yes. I think the interest in Noor has really, you know, really increased over the years. Mm. So when I campaigned for the memorial, and we had the memorial which was unveiled by Princess Anne, everybody got to know about it. You know, it really went around. The media presence there was amazing. All these people came from France. I mean, we filled that Gordon Square and we couldn't let in anymore because it was, you know, invitation only. So they stood around the square. And I'll never forget that sight of people standing around the square holding flowers and roses just because they couldn't get in. And there was this 90-year-old, you know, French resistance people who came and they took the Eurostar and they came, they attended the ceremony and they went back to King's Cross and left. And they said, we would do it. She was our colleague. We would do it for her. So huge respect for her from... There were RAF men who'd flown agents. I mean, they've all passed now, but, you know, this happened in 2012.
Yes.
And they were all around. There was Irene Warner. She was from the WAF. And she knew Noor. She was present there, you know. So it was a very moving ceremony because all these veterans were there. Some who knew Noor and others who'd just come to pay their respect. And there were Sufis because she had two sides to her. The military side as well as the Sufi side. So there was music, there was a lot of music. Her own compositions were played that day.
In the years that have followed the publication of your book, nearly a decade, more than a decade and a half now, and also the unveiling of the memorial to Noor Khan, there has been an absolute explosion of interest. Mm-hmm. Her image is featured everywhere.
Everywhere. In a Doctor Who episode, which was incredible because whole new audience. She's a character in now. She has to send him a radio message for the Doctor.
So how popular has Noor been in contemporary culture?
The interest in Noor has just gone up and up over the years. I find I get so many inquiries about her all the time, not just for documentaries, but for, you know, dramatizations. People want to do plays. They send me artwork they've done on Noor. They've, you know, written poetry for her. So she is, people have really got to know about her a lot. Then, of course, in 2020, we had the blue plaque, which I had campaigned for so many years. That was finally unveiled. So we have the memorial now, and just next to it, her house, 4 Taverton Street. Mm. That address, I wanted that. You know, I wanted the blue plaque there. Mm. And so that happened. And now people go there regularly. There's always flowers near the memorial. Yeah. Somebody's passing through and they go see the blue plaque as well.
How do you account for this level of interest? Is it the emotional resonance of the story? Is it the beauty of her image, that famous image of her in her WAF uniform, this beautiful smile, just or essentially a beautiful incandescent soul, really, that everybody can see. What for you is the quality that really makes so many people identify with this story and with this person?
Well, it was that beautiful photograph that you speak about that drew me. You know, it was an article in a newspaper where it was all about the Indian soldiers, and in a corner was this tiny photograph of Noor in her WAF uniform with that smile. And it was just a caption with a few bullet points about her radio operator. And I just wanted to know. I was drawn to this image. I wanted to know more. So that was the start of my journey. But yeah, I think it's all of these qualities. It's her beauty. It's her courage. More than anything else, it's her courage. And I think there is something universal in that courage. So it's not just South Asian women or Muslim women who have been drawn to her story, because she is like an icon to them, that a young Muslim woman could do this. But I think across the world, I get letters from people in America, Brazil, there's a church there where they've done something and, you know, there's a candle lit for Noor. I mean, it's unbelievable, because I couldn't believe, you know, what interest would there be in Brazil, you know, an Indian secret agent in the Second World War. But there is, and it's her story. There are people who've written to me saying they were ill and then they just thought of how Noor bore up the torture and never gave anything. And they said that got us through. Just thinking of her courage gave us courage. So I think courage filters down to people. And very recently, it was really interesting. There was a young woman from the RAF, ex-RAF now, and she had a scholarship for her first flight. And she said she wanted to recreate the flight, Noor's flight. And she did that from somewhere in Norwich to where Noor was dropped, the field. And that is what she did. Just a tribute to Noor. And she called it the flight for Noor. Amazing. And she's contacted me, sent me the pictures and everything of her in the cockpit. So she has inspired people all over. At the RAF Memorial, they had a digital exhibition on her in Runnymede. There's, you know, the British Museum has a replica of the bust in their South Asia gallery. The National Portrait Gallery has her photograph of hers, which I helped them get. And also the big mural on women that they have, the big sketch, it's a new sketch that has Noor in it. So houses in Camden, a new house in Camden has been called the Noor Inayat Khan House. And the name was voted by residents in the area. You know, people who I don't even know who sort of are so inspired by her story, they want to see it.
As her biographer, how much of the story was already there before you pieced it all together? Like, I mean, what are, was there any of it there? Was there any prior publication? Or was it really piecing it together from various eyewitnesses, from Vera Atkins' memoir, from all these various different accounts and various different sources? I mean, how did you... Like, I mean, how did you approach the piecing of the story together?
So the only account was from her friend, Jean Overton Fuller, who went searching for Noor after the war. So there was one, which I discovered later, but it wasn't very reliable because she didn't have access to the official documents. So she, it's very important because she met many of the people on the field and interviewed them, but her French wasn't very good. So there's a lot that is, there are a lot of mistakes in that book. Which you sift through, but it is important in its own way. I interviewed Jean as Noor's friend, as somebody who knew Noor. So I just wanted her to tell me about Noor, you know, bring out her character to me, which she did. But I think the most valuable were the files, the SOE files, which are in the National Archives. When they were declassified, 2003, that's it, I was there. Because I really, before that, there was nothing. You know, you were just clutching at various little information here and there, nothing much. But that has the details of how she's recruited, how she's sent in, details from the field, her messages from the field. It is just brilliant. And then I read the files of all the other agents who worked with her. So many of the things that are not in her files are in other files. So it is piecing that story together. But of course, her files are the most important. And I believe the National Archives have told me that that is the file that is most sought after in Kew. Can you imagine? I was the first to see it. And I sat there in this closed room just reading these letters, and it is amazing. It's, you know, I was quite happy that I was in a closed room because it is very emotional. And I'm, you know, you're reading her brother's letters saying, my sister is missing. And you can see the desperation, and he's still so polite because they're just so polite. And anyone else would have been screaming, and he's just asking politely, I know you are busy, but you know, what news of my sister? My mother is distressed. And then you see her little notes, you know, you see her messages from the field where she's saying, I'm enjoying myself, and send me a sort of a Fanny style Mac in the next thing. And you know, she tells Vera, your little bird is bringing me luck. I'm enjoying it. So all these, you know, it just brings it to life. So that was a really important source, of course. And that had never been looked at. And of course, her family, because her background to me was very important. I needed to know what made Noor what she was. Mm. And that was the family. Her father was important to me. I needed to find out about him and the rest of the family, the patriarchy, the Indianness, everything. So I contacted the family, and you know, we stay in touch still.
Last question. I don't know really if there's much to say on this point, but the way in which Noor Eniat Khan has become representative of the Indian contribution to the Second World War, what are the feelings about this contribution? What are the feelings in within Indian society, or within Pakistani society, or Bangladeshi society, or perhaps even Sri Lankan society, about the fact that this person has become emblematic of overall South Asian contribution to the Second World War, whose star has risen to the extent that it has in recent decades? What is the feeling within these societies?
I mean, I know that, you know, the book was hugely, still is sold a lot, Spy Princess, in India. It was hugely popular in Pakistan. I've been to many literature festivals there and spoken about Noor, and there's a constant stream of admirers who say, you know, he's so moved by her story. As far as the army go, I don't know. I think some men feel that she's probably, you know, stolen all their thunder and everything, which I can understand that, you know, suddenly she is the one who is represented, but, you know.
Is it because she's wearing Air Force Blue?
Yes. And, well, my only answer to that is deal with it. But, yes. Yeah, I mean, I can see that some who, you know, there have been a lot of Indians in the RAF who've done remarkable work. And, you know, I have read about them as well as the generals who did remarkable work. So, but they're not household names like Noor is slowly becoming. I mean, when the Royal Mail, after the memorial was unveiled, I think that was the second stage. First the book and then the memorial. Royal Mail wanted to bring out a stamp, so they brought out a stamp on Noor. And there's nothing like, you know, Noor's face going through the letterbox to everybody and, you know, what a little brief about who she is. And because she's so striking, and she's obviously, you know, people notice her. They notice that photograph. This is an Asian woman. Yeah. Who was she?
She's outdone the very long list of Indian Victoria Cross winners, of which there are many.
Yes.
And very, very prestigious role of honour that the Indian Army
Absolutely, and they are due. All the honour. Yes, yeah. I mean, it is the book, it is the thing, whatever it is, the campaigns that I have done that Noor has become a household name, and that is it.
Yes. Thank you very much.
There'll be blue.